My name is Jim Nichterlein, and I've been presenting a series on Christians and politics. The particular subject I want to look at today is justice and economic equality. There's probably no more central issue in the whole question of social justice than the question of equality, at least in domestic affairs. And more particularly, fundamental continuing issue or problem or theme of social justice is the relationship between two words, equity and equality. That is, if we think of equity as meaning justice or fairness, I would think probably the greatest single question in the whole field of social justice is, to what extent does equity or fairness require equality? To what extent, if we want to have a politically fair and just system, must that system be equal? And this is the case particularly, I think, with respect to economic equality. And this debate goes on back and forth, has for generations, and will continue to. I want to focus on that today, the question of the relationship between justice and equality, by looking particularly at the work of a man named John Rawls. John Rawls is a political philosopher at Harvard University. And in 1971, he published the book I have listed there on the board, A Theory of Justice. The book, by the way, is not available here in the library. I just checked. And if it were available, I wouldn't recommend that you go and read it anyway. John Rawls is a great book, but it is very heavy going. It is not light reading. It's not medium reading. It's heavy reading. I teach political philosophy, and I, out of professional sense of responsibility, I took 2 weeks off once when I had a sabbatical, part of the sabbatical. I spent 2 full weeks reading John Rawls and trying to figure out what precisely his argument was. I hope today to give the Rawls program in what I hope will be a reasonably clear and straightforward presentation. And it's probably better, if not to get my gloss on Rawls, get somebody else's, rather than wade through it all yourself. You can if you really want to dedicate a substantial portion of your life at some point to it. But at any rate, it's an enormously important book. It is the most important work of political theory in English in modern times.
Can you guarantee that we'll understand it when we walk
out of
here
tonight? No. But if you pay attention, there's a very good chance you should be able to. So perk up, take notes, there'll be a quiz. The book has had an incredible influence. I'd say the most important work of political theory in English, certainly, in modern times. And it's had a great influence, first of all, quite independently of the substantive argument it makes. That is, the importance of Rawls in the first place is that it revived the field of political philosophy and political theory in America, particularly the field of what's called normative political theory. It's simply a term political scientists use. Normative political theory is that which has to do with values, as opposed to empirical political theory, which is scientific study of politics. And what Rawls did, almost single-handedly with this book, is to revive the field of normative political theory or normative political philosophy having to do with values. For most of the 20th century, political philosophy, again in English at least, was dominated by the school of positivism or logical positivism, which said in effect that questions of values are really outside the realm of scientific study. Questions of values are really finally questions of subjective preference. They are the questions of the ought. How ought we constitute a system in terms of our highest values? And those values, the positivists said, are really not subject to scientific empirical analysis. They are questions, they're finally what they are statements of subjective preference. And they may be important to our lives, they may be terribly important to our lives, but from a scientific perspective, there's really not much to say about them because you cannot objectively demonstrate their validity. You cannot prove oughts. You cannot logically show that one ought to believe in fairness, one ought to believe in liberty, one ought to believe in any other range of values you want to have. From the point of view of the positivists, this is really a question while it may be very important to us as human beings, is not important to political philosophy, rightly understood, because political philosophy wants to study truth. And truth is that which can be empirically demonstrated, scientifically proven. And you can't do that with values. This goes all the way back, actually, this idea, to Thomas Hobbes, what he called the emotive theory of value. Values are simply statements of our strongest passions, is what Hobbes said. They are the names we give to the things we feel most strongly about, but we cannot demonstrate independently their validity. Now, what Rawls did is to, in this book, attempt to establish normative principles of justice, and to do so logically and rationally. That is to demonstrate what the positivist said cannot be done, to do what the positivist said cannot be done, to establish normative principles of justice, not on the basis of appeals to transcendent moral ends, not by a religious or moral thing that says, this is what you ought to do, but really to try to create principles of justice as rational principles that would naturally be chosen by free and equal rational beings. That is to establish principles of overriding justice simply on the basis of rationality. Now, substantively, the Rawls program really comes down to what might be called, a number of names you can give to it, but egalitarian liberalism, or another name, welfare state liberalism, or collectivist liberalism, or social democracy, for people who prefer that term. But generally, kind of, his substantive program, as we'll see, comes down to a kind of left liberal prescription for creating justice. Now that, of course, is not original. I mean, welfare state liberalism, social democracy, these are programs that long antedate Rawls. It's a program in which the idea is you combine very substantial amounts of freedom with very substantial amounts of equality. Often it's been argued that you have to trade off between freedom and equality. Rawls thinks you can maximize a great deal of freedom with a very substantial amount of economic equality. They don't have to be seen as contradictory. Now, as I say, it's not original to come up with an idea of welfare state liberalism. That's not new. The originality, as I say, is in the effort to establish that program, to legitimate it in a rational, non-transcendent form of argument, a form of argument in which you come up with substantial egalitarianism without denying human self-interest. Because much of modern egalitarianism has been based on appeals to altruistic moral duty. We have to create a new brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity. We must transcend our self-interest and altruistically share our talents with others. This is what's called, in good Catholic terms, an ethic of supererogation. All supererogation means is it's an act beyond normal moral duty. That is, the argument for egalitarianism is based on what you could call the morality of heroes and saints. You have to transcend your national self-interest, you have to transcend your individualism and care altruistically and unselfishly for others. You have to be willing to sacrifice your principles to help others. That's been the fundamental basis of most appeals to egalitarianism in modern times. And from that has developed, the problem with that has been a lot of people who think of themselves as realists, they then wind up saying this proves that the left is utopian and unrealistic. because egalitarianism depends on us being other than what we are. The fact is we are self-interested creatures. And all of the egalitarians keep saying, you've got to become other than what you are. You have to, in effect, become heroes and saints, or create the morality of heroes and saints. Now, what Rawls says is you can create egalitarianism and base it in something other than this kind of supererogatory ethic, something beyond the moralities of heroes and saints, simple, natural, human morality, consistent with self-interest. So Rawls, when he talks about moral duties, things we owe to each other, he assumes really only low-level natural duties. And what are our natural duties? He says, well, these are the things we owe to each other as free and equal moral beings. Our natural duties are the things we owe to each other as free and equal moral beings. And that's essentially what it is to be human, because to be human is to be a rational creature with the capacity to make moral judgments. That's the essential aspect of our humanity, what differentiates us from the lower animal chain. We are rational creatures and do have a capacity to make moral judgments. And what are the moral duties that proceed from this, then? We have to treat each other as free and equal rational beings. Well, they're not very complicated, and they don't go beyond what most of us think reasonably we can attain. Not to injure others unnecessarily. That's a basic moral principle we owe each other. We have self-defense, but we must not gratuitously, unnecessarily harm each other. That's one. We must treat each other with mutual respect. Treat each other as ends and not simply as means. Treat you as an autonomous moral being, not simply as a means I use for my own purposes. We must uphold justice, once we agree on what justice is. We must protect the innocent. Now, these are all, again, low-level moral qualities that most of us think are not beyond human beings. They are not inconsistent with natural self-interest. It doesn't require an ethic of supererogation. So, again, to this point, the idea is, the aim is to ground moral principles simply in rational choice. Now, any questions at this point as to what it is that Rawls is intending to do? Is this all clear to this point?
It seems like a lot of those theories are still based on moral stance. I mean, maybe it is common, but I still don't see how you can rationalize or scientifically quantify those kind of.
Even at that level, you mean?
Even at that level.
Well, here I don't want to get too much into this. He derives this from Immanuel Kant. And Kant, the German philosopher, and he considers himself a Kantian. Again, the attempt to establish moral principles in rational, on rational grounds. And I guess Kant would say simply by virtue of our being human, we owe each other certain things simply by virtue of our being human. And you can still argue, well, and people have criticized Kant on that, you know, that even these low-level principles he sets up, can you rationally demonstrate them? But let's assume that for the moment for the argument. At least assume they're low-level, they don't require heroic activities, they don't require us to give up our self-interest. In a way, we can say these are qualities it would be reasonable for us to want to have in others. They're rational in that sense, not to treat each other as ends and not means, not to injure each other unnecessarily. We can establish them on the principle that it makes sense for us to act that way toward each other because it fits our rational self-interest. Okay, now, how does he move from these rational principles to substantial equality? Well, what's important here is the procedure he follows. Political philosophy in the West since, I guess, the 17th century has very heavily depended on the idea of trying to establish political principles by assuming a state of nature. That is, assuming when you're trying to figure out how ought a society be organized, what would rational people do to create a society? Ever since Hobbes and then Locke and Rousseau and a lot of others, they've performed a kind of mental experiment, often talking about a state of nature, what men and women were like before they entered politics, a pre-political state. what are the relationships in the state of nature, what do we owe each other in the state of nature, and then proceeding from that, how then, what kind of state should we operate? Rawls has his own version of the state of nature, the pre-political state, and what he calls the original position, and this is the mental experiment that he asks us to perform. We assume the original position, it sounds like a kind of a kinky sex thing, but it's an intellectual construct. We assume the original position behind the veil of ignorance. And in a second, I'll explain what he means by the original position behind the veil of ignorance. It's really not all that complicated. What he's trying to do here, before getting at what he means by that, what he's trying to do in setting up this mental experiment in which we imagine ourselves in that position is to get around the problem of interpreting justice from the point of view of our own particular interests. In one of the earlier sessions, I quoted what I called the cynic's definition of political philosophy. That is, that political philosophy consists of finding reasons for doing things that you wanted to do anyway. In other words, a lot of political philosophy is elaborate rationalization. And a lot of it proceeds from our own self-interest. We tend to find as valid philosophical principles those things that are advantageous to the situation in which we find ourselves. So that very often, exercises in political philosophy, as I say, wind up being rationalizations of self-interest. What Rawls wants to do is to create a situation in which we look for objective, not subjective, principles of justice. And to do that, we have to, as much as possible, Rawls says, rid of ourselves of any sense of what our own situation will be in the kind of society we're trying to establish. We have to try to come up with purely objective principles, things that don't necessarily relate to our own self-interest. We want to find, again, principles of justice that we owe each other, Rawls says, as free and equal rational beings. Now again, when he's talking about this situation, he's assuming we are men and women who, yes, we want to set up a society, a cooperative society in some sense, but without giving up our own interests. Now, how do you tie that in with finding objective principles that disregard our own interests? Well, there you get the original position behind the veil of ignorance. He asks us to perform the mental experiment. What principles of justice would we come up with if we were, in effect, simply disembodied intellects? That is, we're imagining a future society in which we're going to have a role, but we don't know ahead of time anything about ourselves in that society. We don't know what our IQ is. We don't know what our income level is. We don't know what our personality structure is. We don't know anything about what place we are in society. As we're thinking about principles of justice in this new society, which we're going to be a part of, one that's not the one that's consistent with self-interest, but in trying to find objective bases, we have to ahead of time not know what our own particular self-interest will be. And so the assuming the original position and the veil of ignorance, that is, we are ignorant of our own qualities and position in this society, we can, at least if the system works right, Rawls says, come up with principles that any free and equal rational being would agree on, without respect to subjective considerations. It's, again, an attempt to find objective bases for this, for fair justice. Okay, again, is this clear to this point, what he's up to? Any questions? All right. Now, what he comes up with in his system of theory of justice is a set of rules for the distribution of what he calls primary social goods. Now, Rawls does not assume that all of life is public life, political life. He assumes that men and women in this society he's imagining are going to have extensive private lives, extensive voluntary associations to which they belong, matters of vocation, aesthetics, religion, simply common interests that people will be involved in. And his theory of justice has nothing to do with that private realm. That will be free and open. What he's interested in is those things that are collectively important to us, and what he calls the distribution of primary social goods. And so his principle of justice has to find a way of fairly distributing these primary social goods, which he defines as freedom, opportunity, wealth, and what he calls the bases of self-esteem or self-respect. These, he says, are the primary social goods that all of us, basically, virtually all of us, unless we're ascetics, are concerned with. And these are the things, the qualities, the primary social goods, and their distribution that has to be dealt with, that have to be dealt with, if we're going to come up with a system of true justice. Now, what is the basic principle of justice, of distribution of these primary goods that he comes up with? It can be stated quite simply, first as a general proposition, then two subdivisions of it. And again, I'll show how he gets there after I tell what it is he's gotten to. The general principle, he says, is that all social primary goods, this is a direct quote, all social primary goods, as they're defined, are to be distributed equally, unless an unequal distribution of any or all of these goods is to the advantage of the least favored. All social primary goods are to be distributed equally, Rawls says, under justice, unless an unequal distribution of any or all of them is to the advantage of the least favored. So he assumes basic equality, but there can be inequality if those inequalities help the least favored in society. All right, that's the general proposition. He then breaks this down into two things. The first having to do with freedom, essentially. The next having to do with opportunity and wealth. And these, by the way, are in order of importance. He wants to maximize both freedom and equality, but in a certain way, freedom is the most important. You can't sacrifice equality to freedom, Rawls says. Anyway, the first one on freedom. Each person is to have an equal right to the most extensive total system of equal basic liberties compatible with a similar system of liberty for all. In other words, I have freedom to do what I want up to the point where my freedom interferes with your freedom. And this is a basic, again, this is not a new principle of freedom. When we hold up freedom as an ideal, we don't mean totally unlicensed freedom. We mean a freedom that doesn't interfere with or violate other people's freedom. I have the right to free speech and to try to get my opinions established, but I don't have the right to suppress your free speech. And so on. I have the right to swing my arms unless your nose is in the way, then I no longer have the right to swing my arms, so that my freedom cannot be inconsistent with your exercise of freedom. I'll come to that in just a moment. Okay. That's the first principle, equal freedom. That's not controversial, and it's not new for Rawls. People have been talking about equal freedom since at least John Stuart Mill, and before that in the Western tradition. The second point, and here's the most controversial, the rules for distribution of opportunity and wealth in particular. Social and economic inequalities are to be arranged, social and economic inequalities are to be arranged so that they are both A, to the greatest benefit of the least advantage, as you just said, and B, attached to offices and positions open to all under conditions of fair equality of opportunity. In other words, you have to have equality of opportunity, and again, that's nothing very controversial. Most of us believe in equality of opportunity. The controversial part of Rawls's principle is 2A. That is, that social and economic inequalities are to be arranged so that they are to the greatest benefit of the least advantaged. We're back to, this has been called the difference principle. We must have equality in distribution of social and economic goods unless inequality is to the benefit of the least advantaged. All right, now that's the principle, and of course the great question is, why aren't we just back into the trap of altruism? Why should I give up advantages to the least advantaged. If we're assuming self-interest, and again, he's assuming self-interest. Well, before that, let's look at some of the possible criticisms of this difference principle. First of all, from the left, before we get to this criticism for what might be called the right, the criticism from the left is, why allow any inequality at all? Why not have total equality? Well, Rawls assumes that to produce things in society, you need incentives, and that more is produced when you allow incentives for individual advantage. If we have full equality, Rawls is saying in effect, what you might simply get is equal distribution of poverty. To produce more in an economic system, you need incentives for people to produce. We want to distribute a pie in a fair way, but first we have to have the pie. And to get the pie, to have economic abundance, you need certain incentives. He assumes, and this is consistent, I suppose, with certain capitalist ideas, that incentives to allow some degree of inequality, in other words, I can earn more money if I produce more, are justifiable. But only so long, again, as those differences, which I get incentives through higher pay, higher salary, by producing more, are to the advantage of the least advantaged. That is, I'm producing more to be distributed. So even though there's inequality of distribution in this system, the poor will still be relatively advantaged because they'll be getting more and building a bigger pie, so there's more to distribute, to put it in simple terms. So that as long as these inequalities tend toward the creation of a greater pie that can be distributed to the help of the people at the bottom, they're justified. Now, it's important to note here that Rawls does not think that we need as much inequality as we have in America today. He thinks that we can get by, in terms of incentives, to produce more. We don't need the massive inequalities that now exist. We could do with, he never specifies just what amount, but he says we could do with a lot more equality without sacrificing efficiency, without sacrificing incentives, and without sacrificing total production. But there will be inequalities allowed, he says, so long as they are to the net benefit of the least advantaged. All right, that's the criticism from the left. Why not total equality? The criticism from the right, why only inequalities of benefit to the advantaged? Why not, a person might say, whatever the competitive market decrees? That is, as long as we can assume freedom of opportunity, why not simply say that is just and reasonable, what rational people would choose, whatever results from free competition? That's, of course, a standard argument that we're all, I think, familiar with. Why would not rational, free, and equal people, in the original position behind the veil of ignorance, pick as their theory of justice that whichever results from free competition? Well, this is, I think, the most important technical part of Rawls' argument. He argues from what he calls the maximin principle. M-A-X-I-M-I-N, maximin. And he takes this idea over from game theory, how people make decisions given certain circumstances. Now remember, when we're making choices about our principles of justice, we're behind this veil of ignorance. We don't know what our own situation is going to be. We don't know if we're going to be rich or poor. We don't know if we have the abilities to make ourselves rich or poor. Now, and we're interested in our own self-interest, so we want to come up with principles of justice that will protect us regardless of what our particular qualities will be in terms of the ability to make money. So what Rawls says is that in this maximum, or in this situation where you're behind the veil of ignorance, you're in a position of great uncertainty as to your own self-interest because you don't know specifically what your self-interest will be because you don't know what your particular qualities are going to be. The maximin principle tells us in game theory, when you're making decisions, that in a situation of great uncertainty, the most rational choice is to choose the least bad alternative. That is, when we're in this, behind this veil of ignorance, if we say, well, we're going to choose a market situation or whatever fair competition leads to, since I don't know at that point how good I'm going to be at making money, I could wind up very poor. Maxim in principle tells us I will choose instead a theory of justice or a theory of social arrangements where wherever I wind up, the worst situation will hurt me the least. And it's by this then you come up with inequalities that are justifiable only when they help the least advantaged. So that wherever I wind up, using maximum principles, wherever I wind up in this system, I will be, even if I'm at the bottom, I'll be relatively better off than I would be, assuming I might wind up at the bottom, in a pure capitalist market arrangement. So that it's rational, that in thinking about my self-interest without knowing my specific qualities, it's rational to choose this least bad alternative. So that this makes more sense, without knowing my particular qualities ahead of time, than does choosing a system of market distribution. Now, does that answer your question as to why a rational person would choose it? Is that clear to anyone? Everyone?
It's clear, but this is assuming, for example, not a world economy, but a national economy.
Yeah. I suppose this could be, it's been a dozen years since I've read it, I suppose it could be extended in principle to a world economy, but he's basing it basically on an internal society, you know, a society of people coming together. Okay, any other questions for clarity or understanding here? Again, we're trying to come up with rational principles, and given this game theory assumption, you don't know what your situation is going to be, it makes sense to choose this. Because even if things turn out the worst in terms of my own position in that society, it's going to be better than it would be if the worst came up in a market society. It's less risk. You get less payoff. That is, if you assume ahead of time, I don't know what my own situation is going to be, in a pure market economy, I might wind up to be very rich, richer than I would be under Rawls's theory of justice. But he says that game theory teaches us that when you're in this position of great uncertainty, the more rational choice is to choose the one that'll be least disadvantageous than what might be the most advantageous. And it's a rational thing for us to do that because we're risk-averse with creatures in a certain way. So this is how he comes up with a system that is essentially egalitarian, but whose creation does not depend on appeal to abstract moral principles. It depends on rational choice. Now, this is all a mental experiment. Now, okay, if there are no other questions at this point, what possible arguments can be raised against this and have been raised against it? Well, there are a number of them. I'll take a couple of the perhaps less serious ones first. He uses phrases like inequalities are to be arranged so that, or social goods are to be distributed so that, and he never gets down to the point of who does all this distributing. That is, he doesn't talk about the social mechanism by which we distribute economic goods. So one criticism that's been made again by certain conservatives is that he doesn't deal with the problem of power. Presumably, you're going to need a pretty strong state to decide which inequalities are justified and to cut them off at that point. And Rawls doesn't really talk about the problem of the concentrated power that might be involved there, the problem of a strong state doing this distributing. Now, he might say if we can all agree in theory ahead of time, we can agree as to how to do it. But then that leads to the second associated point. How do you put into practice this difference principle? That is, how do you know what degree of inequality is still conducive to the greatest net advantage for the people at the bottom? That is, this is a practical problem or a practical question. When do incentives lead simply to greater the maximum production for all, and when do incentive simply leads for me the possibility to grow as rich as I want to be, where my wealth, the incentives that are added to me, given to me, no longer contribute to the people at the bottom, where they simply become purely those things that that contribute, in fact, a greater distance between rich and poor. In other words, you've got a problem of economic specificity here, a problem of economic, technical problem. How do we know what degrees of inequality are required to make sure that the maximum amount is produced for the society as a whole, with particular concern for the people at the bottom? Because remember, as soon as you get inequalities that go beyond the necessity of helping the least advantaged, you've violated Rawls' principles. And that, since economics is an art and not a science, you've got a technical problem there, I think. We don't know. But these are, in a way, technical problems, at least in theory, could be done away with. The more substantive, the most substantive criticism I've run across of Rawls' principle is that people say what's wrong with it is that it deprives people of the right to the use of their own abilities. That is, why should, if I have all the ability in the world to make money, I'm just smarter than heck and I have a lot of incentive and a lot of energy, why should I not be allowed to reap the benefit of those qualities? As long as I'm doing it fairly, there's free, fair competition, there's no injustice, there's no discrimination we're assuming here. But as long as what my riches come from simply the use of my abilities, why should I be deprived of them? Why can I only have more if it's to help people at the bottom? Well, now he comes at it through this kind of maximin thing. That is, that it's as we've just seen, well, it's more rational to choose that. But Rawls says, and this is what makes his argument kind of intriguing, he says the results of the decisions that we reach from this original position should be consistent with our considered moral judgments. Otherwise, there's something wrong with those principles. In other words, if I say Rawls's maxim in principle has led me to a conclusion that I think is unjust, that is, I am not allowed to reap the benefits of my abilities, then Rawls would admit if the conclusions we reach from his original position do not match with what seem to us to be fair moral principles, then his system is brought under severe question. So you might say then, all right, now I've come up with the real Achilles heel here. The problem is you're taking my ability and forcing me to give it to others. Why should I have to do that? That does not come down to a rational or fair moral principle. Now, how does Rawls justify this? Well, he does so by saying fundamentally that we can assume that personal attributes, including the attributes to make money, intelligence, drive, all these other things, personality structure, can be used as a collective asset in the pursuit of primary social goods because we as individuals have no moral right to them. That is, if I'm born smarter than you, that's not something I've achieved. It is a gift. And therefore, I have no moral right to say that I have the right to the advantage of those qualities to be used in my own interest, because there's no moral foundation for it. It's simply something I have to be born with. I'm born smart, you're born dumb. That's simply the luck of the draw. Or I'm lucky in economics and you're unlucky in economics, which happens a lot. And again, I can't claim moral the benefit for being in the right place at the right time, and I built the mousetrap and so on that made me a lot of money and you didn't happen to. That's luck. And even, he says, personal qualities, drive, energy, and so on, those things are largely given us, partly by our genes and partly by our family structure and support. I happened to get born into a family that gave me encouragement for education, that instilled in me certain disciplines of hard work, ambition, whatever else is required to make money. And so essentially those things are assets given to me, not in the sense by God or nature, but by my parents, by society. So again, I have no moral claim to them. They are simply things, though those qualities that allow me to be more successful than my neighbor are qualities that the distribution of which is morally arbitrary. Individuals have no moral claim to them. Well, this, I think you can see, is why this is the most controversial. Because what one can argue is you push this far enough, you wind up, it seems to me, with a kind of abdication of personal responsibility. Because if everything that we are is simply what is given to us, then I don't think, speaking of moral philosophy as a whole, you wind up with a situation where there are not good actions or bad actions in terms of their being morally praiseworthy or morally worthy of condemnation, because everything that I am, not just my ability to make money, but presumably this would hold up for my moral principles as well. If I turn out to be courageous, honest, compassionate, any quality you want to mention, if everything that I am is simply that which is given me by society, then there's no way that you can say to me or I can say to you, you are a good person or you are not a good person. You wind up with a kind of determinism, with an absence of moral qualities. The way I picture this to my students, and it always works with my students because the analogy hits very close to home. It's one thing to say the ability to make money has to do with certain arbitrary qualities you're born with or not born with. You know, as I say, some people are smart and some people are not so smart. And I put this with respect to my students, the same thing. You can say that people should not be given differential grades. They should all get the same grade because, you know, some people are naturally smarter than others, and there's no virtue in that. Why should they get a higher grade for something that's a gift? Well, if you put it in those terms, you can make a moral case for it. I mean, there's no reason why you're stupid and you get a D and he's smart and he gets an A. You know, you didn't earn that because you were given that. Well, you might argue that, but the more common case among my students is roughly equal ability but differential results. Why? Because of effort. Some students work harder than others. They're equal in intelligence, but not all equally intelligent students get the same grades. It's very obvious. Some work hard and get A's, and some don't work and get D's and F's. And we think that's just. We say that, you know, given those equal abilities, they got disproportionate rewards because, one, morally, did good things, worked hard, studied hard. In that situation, studying hard and being serious is the morally right thing to do. And so those differential results, then, you can say, are justified. The question becomes, does that analogy then apply to economics? That is, assuming that there's a substantial amount of equality among us, large numbers of us. After all, there are very few of us that are geniuses or idiots. Most of us are somewhere in the middle. A lot of us have roughly equal talents, economic talents. And one can argue that in terms of justice, this is what conservatives argue against Rawls, it is not unjust for there to be differential results and for me to have the benefits of my hard work, my application, my stick-to-itiveness. In fact, it would be unfair to take away the benefits of that for me. That is, I worked hard and I got more. To give it to you, you have equal ability to me, but you're a lazy bum. And why should the results of my hard work be given to you? This is, I think, the strongest conservative criticism that's been made of Rawls' theory. They say that he winds up coming up with a principle that violates an essential sense of justice, and that he can't use the Maximin principle to override that, because Maximin is simply a kind of utilitarian trick. I mean, it's a mechanism. It's not a moral judgment in itself. It's a mechanism to wind up with certain principles. And if a Maximin theory or principle leads you to a situation that you perceive as unjust, then there's something wrong with the Maximin principle, and you can throw it out. All right, these are, I think, the substantial arguments that have been made. So one could argue that, finally, if one buys that part of the argument, you could say, well, you could still use the Maximin principle, combine it with justice, your sense of justice that unequal results among people are justified, and yet in rational theory still protect yourself by saying we will allow in our society for market distribution according to ability, but that we will have a minimum, a social minimum for people at the bottom. No one will be allowed to be in poverty. So then you've covered your maximum worst outcome. At least you know you won't starve. And yet you might then say, but beyond that, beyond taking care of the basic necessities of life, we will then allow for more random distribution. And then you're back to the argument about, you know, how much equality does equity require? Well, that is John Rawls in sort of comic book form, or simple form, simplified outline. I hope I haven't distorted his basic principles. What do you think of all this? Any responses? The book itself has spawned an enormous literature. I mean, whole issues of philosophical journals, one after another, have been given over to critiques of Rawls and questions about Rawls. Books have been written in response to Rawls. So quite aside, again, I want to get back to the point that quite aside from the substantive things he came up with, the great value to those of us who teach and care about political philosophy is he's got us back talking about values, which political philosophy ought to talk about. It's not just a technical game of what you can scientifically prove. Yeah.
Can you give a concrete example of arranging an economic or social inequality to benefit the least advantaged?
Well, what it means is, I don't know how concrete I can make this, he would say that you are going to distribute your economic pie, the gross national product, basically equally. But, he says, if you don't allow for any incentives, that is differential rewards at all, your pie is going to be awfully small. And so your danger, if you require absolute equality of conditions, there's no incentive for me to work harder because I'm going to get the same as anybody else anyway. None of us will have much incentive to work hard, again, we're assuming self-interest, if no matter what we do, we all get the same. So he's assuming a certain human psychology of self-interest. If there's some rewards that I can get for working harder, then I will work harder. And as I work harder, I will produce more. And as a lot of people produce more, that economic pie grows. So you've got a larger pie to distribute, so people have more. So that what you want to do in the ideal, again, this is highly abstract, is to allow just that much incentive, just that much unequal payment, so that you will maximize the pie to the least advantage. So what you would do, presumably, is set certain kinds of income limits. You'd arrange your tax laws in certain ways, so that a person would be allowed to keep, you know, a certain proportion of his or her increased income. And then beyond that, that would be taxed away, distributed to the poor. You do it, if you're going to operationalize this, it seems to me, put it into practice, you would do it through the tax system. And simply set up your tax scheme so that you allow, you know, it's the idea of you want to set a tax rate at that point in which you get the highest revenues. And you don't always get, I mean, you can't necessarily say the higher the rate, the higher the revenue. Because, for example, to use an obvious example, if the tax rate is 95%, you're not going to get much tax revenue because people aren't going to work more if they have to give over 95%. What you want to do, I think, in Rawls' system would be to find a kind of optimal tax rate that will encourage people to produce, bring in maximum amount of revenue so you have more to distribute to the poor, the least advantage. And yet only allow those inequalities that continue to contribute to that building of the larger pie. And as I say, one of the problems, precise problems, is how specifically would you do that? Where precisely would you set the tax rates? How would you put this into effect? But at least theoretically, that can be done. Theoretically, you can work out a way for doing this.
I still think that with Rawls seriously, it has to be looked at on a world economic base. Otherwise, I can say, oh, I can develop all this just for my family and forget the state, forget the nation. And when you talk about freedom and justice, we give up the largest piece of the pie all too often, not because of incentives within our community, but by grabbing elsewhere in order to achieve a more hearty hunger for themselves.
Well, again, theoretically, I think you could extend his system to the world because we're performing a mental experiment here, so we're assuming there will not be discrimination, there will be fair rules of competition, There will be fair trade, however you define that. And so you could say that the same principles that apply to a nation state and distribution of goods could be then globalized. I mean, at least it seems to me you'd then have to have a global decision-making body. It couldn't, obviously, you'd have to supersede nationalism. But theoretically,
at least. What I'm saying is that what we should do is looking at our own piece of pie. Now, I'm not talking about the pie, I'm talking about our piece, the United States. We should do this within our own piece to see if our piece can enlarge within itself rather than taking. Because otherwise, you could never. I'm a rationalist enough to know that we can never set up a world system to pull this off. But I'm an idealist enough to say maybe we could do this within our own country if we would stay within our own country. And think of these principles of freedom. How is our freedom, as you said, how are we violating other people's freedom in order to guard our own freedom? And that's where I think it starts breaking down.
Well, one technical problem there is you can't stay within your own country economically. I mean, the world doesn't work that way where we have an international economic order.
Who are we violating when we move over our boundaries? Who are we robbing? Who are we taking from? Or how is this doing both of us good?
But see, you're assuming that by going beyond we're robbing and taking and so on.
No.
And I'm saying that theoretically you can assume fair rules of trade that won't do that.
Right. And that's what I say. That's what we should then do. And Rawls would agree with that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have to have fairness. I mean, there must be fair equality of opportunity, he says. So that's part of the assumption, There will be no...
Outside both our pie, not only within it.
Well, our pie. Unless you make it a global pie, then you've got one huge pie. I don't know. I'm not sure I can say that in any direct form. That is, that there's been a direct influence. I would think you could say it's true in the sense that his book really revived the debate, first of all among academics, but I think spreading out from there, about this whole system of justice as fairness, and how do you try to do this? What kind of, how do you try to put it into effect? What kind of tax system, for example, will come closest to putting his principles into operation? But to my knowledge, Rawls is not a political activist. He writes his books there at Harvard and lets people apply them as they will. Yeah.
How does this then come together with you give the example of the people in your class, equal ability, different grade. They might be getting poor grades in your class, but in their engineering courses, they're getting good grades. Whereas the people that are getting good grades in your class are getting poor grades in engineering because of their interests.
Yeah.
Now, how does that play into the economic field when someone chooses to go into a field that is on the lower demand end of the economic sector as opposed to those people because of their interests that go into a field? Is that, again, one of those givens? Your interest is given to you and is not yours?
Yeah, well, Rawls would say, I think Rawls would fit in that way, I suppose. That is that if I choose to be a poet and you choose to be an entrepreneur, these are things that are part of, again, our intellectual, moral, or intellectual personality makeup that we have, these things are largely given to us. They are, givens. And that, therefore, there's no reason in principle why an engineer should get paid more than a poet, except to the degree that the engineer's activities might help bigger pie we're talking about more effectively than being a poet does. So I think Rawls would say it's not unfair that an engineer make more money than a poet, but what he would do is put very severe limitations on this. Does that? I think that would be his response. As long as those inequalities are helping build a bigger pie from which the poor can benefit, then it's all right. When that pie grows only to help that engineer, then it's no longer just, on Rawls' principles, because it goes beyond.
Does that justify what's happening in South Africa today? Could he justify that basis of
how do you mean?
Bigger pie. Apartheid helps create
I see what you mean. Well, remember, he puts this in what he calls lexical order, these two principles. And the first principle is that all have a right to equal freedom. What was the precise reading? Each person is to have an equal right to the most extensive total system of equal basic liberties compatible with a similar system of liberty for all. And then he says, that's the first principle. The second one is social equality or economic equality. And you can't sacrifice freedom, liberty, to equality. So you couldn't, he would say they can't use that. That South Africa is unjust because it violates the first principle that people would choose behind a veil of ignorance. Who would choose to be subservient? Nobody, no rational person would. So it's unjust because it's not rational in that sense.
Yeah, I guess the problem that I have with Rawls is that the assumption that he starts off with is that people act on the basis of rational self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, naturally he's talking about economics, so he tends to focus on that. But I guess, and I can't prove it, but I guess I think that people may tend to do that, but I think people are motivated by more than that, and consistently motivated by more than that. And I think that, you know, in other words, I think he makes some assumptions about people that may not be totally correct.
That's the point a lot of people have made, that we are not simply rational, self-interested creatures. We are that, but we do have altruistic, self-giving motivations, and that his system doesn't call for it. But I think in defense of Rawls, he would say, well, look, you can exercise those in your private life all you want, and I'm not denying them, I'm not denying their reality. What I'm trying to do is come up with a realistic system for a large society. In a way, it's a kind of Niebuhrian argument. Niebuhr would say we as individuals in our personal relations can be altruistic, self-giving, self-sacrificing, but that it's unrealistic, you know, given sin, to assume that for a large mass society. You have to assume, given large masses of people in large groups, rational self-interest.
I think the place that Niebuhr would disagree with them, though, is when you get to the experiment, you assume, you know, the original position behind the veil of ignorance is this rational, disembodied intellect.
Right.
And I think Niebuhr, you know, on the basis of his anthropology, would say there is no such thing as a disembodied intellect. We're,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're put together, bodies and minds, and when you try to, you're dealing with an abstraction that doesn't exist when you try to think about a disembodied rational.
Yeah, somebody said that after all, we make decisions, I mean, that his is so, that his whole situation is unrealistic in the sense that we, in fact, don't live behind the veil of ignorance. We are moral creatures in the middle of things, and we make decisions knowing what our own qualities are, knowing what the situations of others are. And we do so not just, as you say, on the basis of rational self-interest, as sort of, you know, we're logical machines.
Yeah.
We do it also as...
We walk around
yeah.
with this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. We do it as moral beings. And that our qualities are part of what we are, that we are not disembodied intellects.
Mm-hmm.
We are whole human beings who make whole choices.
Isn't his idea, though, to talk about how we can establish society with rules and laws?
Mm-hmm.
Based on, and you decide on these rules and laws based on this principle, knowing
yeah.
that we have all these other things
mm-hmm.
to talk about. So
yeah.
he's not dealing with a different situation.
Yeah, yeah, he's trying to get beyond, assuming we all know we have interests, qualities, aren't disembodied intellects, given all that and given those inevitable differences among us, how can we establish a principle for discussion of fair principles that gets beyond it? And so it's this, as he says, it's a mental experiment that you're performing. To try to arrive at objective principles. He would say, obviously, in the way we live in society, we are whole creatures, and that's why he leaves a very large realm for private and voluntary existence that has nothing to do with social primary goods. Any other questions we have? Yeah, oh, sorry. Yeah, up there.
I wonder if he makes any, you know, you're talking about he would have people who produce more would pay than higher tax. So
yeah, because they get paid more.
So this would theoretically go to help benefit the poor, but I'm just thinking, it seems to me like in our system where half your, over half your withholding tax goes to pay for defense, that you're making more money and half that money is going just for a dead end, I guess, is what I would say. It seems to me that would he have any kind of moral judgment, like a society shouldn't be spending more than a certain percentage of your tax on something that doesn't benefit people, like, you know, bonds and chemical workers?
Well, I suppose, I don't, as I recall, he doesn't get into this much in his book. I assume, given his principles, he would say that a nation has the right to as much defense as it needs. And then we're left with the question of defining how much do we need. There's, assuming a world in which there are competing self-interests, you can say we need some defense, but, you know, the question is how much. But that, he doesn't really get into that. He's, again, not assuming, not talking about any real world society. He's trying to set up a model, in a way, against which we can measure our own situation. It's not that he thinks this could be perfectly, you might say he wouldn't even think this could be perfectly instituted any place, but it might be a model for us to measure an ideal against which to measure that which we do. The question of defense, I think, would get into an area beyond what he is really concerned himself with.